kids. Matt Segundo here, and I'm glad to return after a lengthy absence, seeing as how the Liplog Co-op Bolsheviks are gone. I had spent the past few weeks leading various higher education classes, trying to get people to believe in my non-religious system of empowerment that involved the consumption of tequila and how it could actually take control of your life. Take one shot, and you'll be able to balance your checkbook. Take two shots, and you'll be able to see God. Well, it seems that not everybody was willing to reject sobriety, and not everybody was willing to take shots and remark upon the interesting sexual companions they'd wake up with in the morning. So I can relate in part to this week's guest's noble struggle. Richard Dawkins is doing his best to get people not to believe so readily in magical deities, or fairies, or voices, or little sorts of delirium tremens. I don't know. But as our young roving correspondent learned, it seems that such a strict plan permits a scholar to become often rigid.
So I'm here with Richard Dawkins, author of The Selfish Gene, and most recently, The God Delusion. Richard, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Okay. I wanted to actually ask you first, what is the audience for this book specifically, would you say?
I think it's partly people who are already unbelievers, but are a bit shy or even frightened to come out and admit it. Mm-hmm. So I want to say to those people, don't be shy, don't be frightened, there are plenty of you. Stand up, recognize each other, come out of the closet and say what your beliefs really are. The second audience is those people who vaguely think of themselves as religious, but haven't really given it much thought, don't feel very strongly about it, probably haven't bothered to think about it. I mean, there are better things to think about, perhaps they might think. I want them to give it a second thought and realize that perhaps the religion of their parents and grandparents is a lot of nonsense.
Yeah. You note in the preface that, you know, for example, picking up this book for some people might be Satan. You know, it might be, you know, basically reading the hands of Satan.
Well, people are warned about that, and their childhood indoctrination has told them that the devil will come and the devil's arguments will be highly plausible and they'll sound very good and sound very reasonable. Don't listen to them. It's only the devil talking. Yeah. So they are prepared with that warning.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I wanted to actually touch upon one section of the book, The Roots of Religion. You actually bring up your concept of memes as well as a comparison to Chinese whispers and the like. I wanted to actually ask, though, is there any sort of really kind of foolproof evolutionary biological explanation for this human capacity to believe, this tendency for, you know, people to kind of just really believe in anything, really, not just religion?
I'm one of those, quite a number of biologists now, who take the view that there isn't a survival value of religion itself. It's the wrong question. There's a survival value in some kind of psychological predisposition which manifests itself as religion under the right circumstances. That's actually quite a common thing in biology. You see something that an animal does, and you say, what's the survival value? What's the Darwinian advantage of that? And then you realize that wasn't the right question. You shouldn't be asking a question about that thing. You should be asking, what's the survival value of having the kind of brain which produces that thing under some circumstances, but not under other circumstances? And I think that's what religion is.
Okay, well, let's talk about religion. You cite numerous sort of bad precedents for religion throughout history within the text, for example, the cargo cults, the whole scenario with Abraham's wife and the like. And yet, I actually want to point out that some religious-based organizations actually do some good. For example, if you take a look at the Salvation Army, which started off as a really kind of, you know, essentially fundamentalist organization, and until actually the 1900 Galveston, Texas hurricane, it only then became this sort of way to kind of galvanize money, and in disseminating the money, it never really sort of, you know, told people, oh, well, you must believe in God to actually get this kind of cash or get this kind of aid.
That is perfectly true, and plenty of good people are religious, and some religious organizations are good. Others are not. And Mother Teresa is legendarily good, and yet she would never give. I mean, it was always the quid pro quo was you had to become Catholic. I mean, she was actually a very wicked woman, in my view. Now, as for the money, lots and lots of people want to give money when there's a terrible disaster, when there's a tsunami or a hurricane or something of that sort. And you give it through charity. The vast majority of charitable giving in the United States is given through church organizations. It's exceedingly easy for church organizations to get tax-deductible status. They certainly ought to be giving money to hurricane victims and things. They're getting all this tax-free money. It is possible for non-religious organizations to get tax-deductible status, and they do sometimes do it, but they don't have a fast track the way religious organizations do. Religious organizations are exceptionally well-heeled, exceptionally wealthy, and they really do use their money for all sorts of other things which are explicitly religious, as well as siphoning off some of it for good causes like hurricane relief.
Mm-hmm. But is a religious organization so bad if they are actually, you know, let's say 10% of it is used for, you know, the dissemination of, like, you know, religion, but 90% of it is used to actually help people? Is there any, you know, why is it such a bad thing necessarily for a religious?
Well, it may or may not be a bad thing. I was just really replying to your point religious organizations do give money to things like disaster relief. So they blooming well ought to give money. They've got enough of it.
Sure. Okay. Well, I actually wanted to note the comparison of religion as a sort of supernatural imaginary construct comparable to sort of a pink elephant or hearing voices and the like. I actually, though, want to propose, is seeing a pink elephant necessarily a bad thing? Is hearing voices a bad thing? You compare, for example, you know, agnostics to Neville Chamberlain, but Winston Churchill actually heard voices.
Yeah, okay, maybe hearing voices isn't always harmful. Mm. I just think it's a shame. I mean, we only have one life. It's a shame to go through your life believing in a delusion and listening to voices and praying to an imaginary friend when you could be living a proper life yourself in the real world, which is a wonderful world to be living in. So it may not actually be bad. Of course, it sometimes is bad when it inspires people to suicide missions, to flying planes into skyscrapers and things, because you believe you're being fast-tracked to a martyr's heaven if you do that. You believe, I mean, those people were not psychos. They were deeply religious, sincerely religious people who really honestly believed that God wanted them to do that and that they would go to paradise for doing it. So there can be evil that flows from it, but mostly I think it's just a waste of a life to go through life putting your trust in an imaginary friend.
We actually had here in San Francisco the shooting of Moscone and the shooting of Harvey Milk, and there was the infamous Twinkie defense, you know, to defend his actions, that he had too much Twinkies. I mean,
so I don't know what a Twinkie is. You'll have
a Twinkie is a really detestable snack that is enjoyed by Americans.
Oh, okay.
It's really, believe me, you're not missing much.
Okay.
But I mean, I guess I want to use this comparison to point out that some people will, you know, whether it's religion or whether it's some sort of imaginative variable in place, they're going to believe in something, and I'm not necessarily certain if it can be used for good or for bad. I mean, like, you know, I will sometimes, you know. Look, when I'm reading Pynchon's new novel right now, and when I read it, when I open it up, I completely, absolutely believe in the Chums of Chance and their daring sorts of adventures with a hydrogen airship. But
yes,
when I
course.
Close the book,
yes.
you know,
yes.
it's I'm in the real world.
Yes.
So
that's true. But reading a fiction is a very good example. I think it is sad when people can't tell the difference between fiction and fact. I mean, as long as you are clear in your mind that this is fiction and that's fact, that doesn't do any. It probably doesn't do any harm anyway. I mean, you know, if somebody goes through life with their head in a sort of fictional cloud, it may not do any harm. I just think it's such a waste. I mean, the real world is such a wonderful place to be in. Let's open our eyes and live in the real world.
But sometimes looking so hard into the real world and looking just, you know, particularly in this environment, in the current sort of, you know, climate right now, can be utterly sort of depressing to just concentrate exclusively on the real. Is there not some sort of value in some sort of imaginary construct of any kind, whether it be religion?
Well, there might be, but it wouldn't be valuable if it distracted your attention from the need to change whatever is dreadful about the real world. I mean, if the real world is indeed a bad place, do something about it. Don't lose your head in a cloud of fiction.
Well, at the same time, what can one do exactly? That's again the limit.
Well,
here.
I think we've talked our way through this point enough now.
Okay. Well, you point out actually that you make reference to a zeitgeist where you sort of note that concepts often change throughout the course of a nation's history. You specifically make the comparison to women's suffrage. However, I'm not certain if, you know, I'm actually going to give you something that you've probably seen quite a lot of, and if I can actually get it out of my pocket. We have a problem here in America, and on this coin there are four words there that have been in place since the 1860s.
In God We Trust?
Yes.
Has that really been... I thought it was the 1950s.
No, it's been... It's had a long history. It started with the Civil War, and it's been in, you know... It's been there for 150 years in some form or some
okay.
kind of form.
So what's the story about it being on... Maybe it's on dollar bills that it's only been since the 1950s.
I think you're right,
yeah,
actually.
Okay.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, for something like this, let's see. Here's a $5 bill, and... Oh, here it is on the back.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that one I think does go back only to the 1950s.
Yeah.
In any case, what's the question?
The question is given this reality and how, particularly with governmental, it's on our currency, can something that is so embedded, so apparently meaningful to our nation and our government, something that 95% of the population here in America actually believes in God, something that is just so fixed...
Well, which God?
Yeah.
The Jewish God, the Muslim God, the Christian God, the Hindu God? Why just say God?
Well, that's a good question, yeah. But it's generally assumed that it's a sort of Christian God, but that is a very good point. But I guess since the notion of God is so in the American culture and on our currency, how
yes.
can it be expected...
So why is it against... I mean, what's that about the Constitution, then, and the separation of church and state? You'll gather that I'm not American and
yes.
don't know this, but I thought there was a... I thought the American Republic was founded on a separation between church and state as part of the Constitution.
Freedom of religion, yes.
I mean,
you know, in the First Amendment.
Yes.
But still, you know, at the same time, there's this kind of interesting sort of God is very much in our culture.
I mean. Well, maybe it is. So, I mean, that seems to me like a rather bad thing.
Yeah.
Why ask me about it? I mean, I sympathize.
I guess, though... You say the zeitgeist can change, as
yes.
it did for women's suffrage. Do you have any, can you prognosticate on how it might change with, like, religion getting that 95% number down?
Well, I'm doing my best, and many of my friends are as well. I think it's somewhat illusory. I suspect that the stranglehold that religion has over American culture is not as bad as one might fear. Certainly the people that I meet who mostly are university people, I suppose I'm a university person myself, going around the country from one university to another, I very seldom meet anybody who's really religious. I suspect that the stranglehold that religion has over the Congress, it's impossible for an atheist to get elected
sure.
to the United States Congress. That's got to mean that a lot of them are lying. I mean, statistically speaking, it's inconceivable that that number of educated, in some cases rather intelligent people could all be religious. They've at least a substantial number of them have got to be pretending to be religious in order to get elected. I think we have a task to raise consciousness so that that's no longer true, so it's no longer necessary to simulate religious belief in order to get elected.
I guess, though, why not just go ahead and you could take, you actually bring up the concept of Noma, and I actually wanted to ask, why should even religion be a question at all? Why can't one person just simply exist, and when asked the question, oh, what church do you go to, or what denomination you are, you know, you just decide not to answer, and you say, look, that's a very personal, private matter. I mean, is this not a way to kind of perhaps, like, you know, get people thinking off religion in the sense of, like, you know, what I believe in is really none of your business. I have no intention of telling you. And really...
Yeah, I mean, that would be fine, but very many religious believers do actively impose their beliefs on others. They actively use their beliefs not just to govern their own lives, but to say, we are not going to allow stem cell research, we are not going to allow abortion, we're not going to allow gays to have their rights, because it's against our religion. Never mind whether it's against other people's religion. We want to impose our religious restrictions on the rest of you. So that's one substantial argument, I think, against that. Intolerance has to work both ways.
Well, certainly, but at the same time, you can ignore those people. I mean, you know, of course, you're dealing with politics, and now you're dealing
well,
with a situation
which
you
can't.
Must play.
I mean, there is no federal money available for stem cell research
yeah.
because of the religious bigotry of the present U.S. government.
But see, our political situation here is such that the Democrats are pretty much, you know, being walked on, essentially.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so if someone were to sort of maybe perhaps adamantly sort of protest this kind of thing, then perhaps, you know, I'm prognosticating too here.
Yeah, well, go for it.
Well, I guess what I'm sort of suggesting is that you know, the question of when to be vocal about one's religious beliefs or one's atheism versus remaining silent about it. I mean, it's just like my theory here, which I was kind of running with this, was that if you just basically sort of shut up and you gauge things exclusively without religion, then religion isn't necessarily a qualifier. you know? Or is religion so interlocked with culture that we, you know, we can't do that?
I think it'd be very nice if we could do that, and that's pretty much is what happens in Britain and in Europe, as a matter of fact. I think in America it doesn't happen because religion is so incredibly powerful, and religious lobbies do have such power over getting out the vote and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So, and the same is true in the Islamic world. So we in Europe, in the middle, feel rather trapped in a kind of pincer movement between incipient theocracies in the United States and in the Islamic world. It's a very uncomfortable position to be in.
Is there any sort of, you know, we're talking about like the power of, you know, other people to lobby against government or to lobby even against societal sort of values. Is there no sort of gray area, going back to this concept of noma, in which you sort of suggest that even if religion and science were to be in almost two separate sort of entities, that inevitably society kind of favors religion over science? Well, let's say if we recalibrated that, would there be a sort of way for both of them to kind of operate where...
Yes, I mean, NOMA stands for Non-Overlapping Magisteria. Yeah. It was coined by Stephen Jay Gould, and it was a sort of attempt to keep religion and science in different compartments. They're about different things, according to him. They don't overlap, they don't conflict, because one of them is about the Rock of Ages and the other's about the age of the rocks and little aphorisms like that. It's not true, of course. I mean, religion steps all the time on science's turf. Any miracles, and miracles are probably the dominant reason, including the miracle of creation, so-called, would the dominant reason why people are religious. That is stepping on science's turf. Mm-hmm. Religion steps on society's turf when it imposes its beliefs and its views and its prohibitions on other people. NOMA would be a fine thing if the religious side showed the sort of reticence that Steve Gould would wish them to show, but they don't. They want to boss the rest of us around, both in America and in the Islamic world.
Is it one's duty, if one wants to live without religion, to essentially, I mean, because it also inflicts our language, particularly in a profane matter. Profanity started off as a kind of swearing to the gods, and there are still vestiges of that. But if I sometimes slip out, for God's sake, I could always use something like, for fuck's sake.
Yeah.
But if I use that, then I'm going to immediately
I've no problem with using God. I mean, it's part of the language. It's part of our culture. So saying God bless you, or when you sneeze or something like that, I have no problem. Some people do have a problem with that. I mean, I've got friends who want to rigorously censor the word God from their language. I don't want to bother with that, no. Hmm. I've got better things to worry about than that.
Is this the sort of sliver of doubt between 6 and 7?
Or? No, not at all. No. It's just that language, we use words in sloppy ways.
Yeah.
And when I say, my God, that's a big so-and-so,
yeah.
I don't really mean I believe in God. Of course I don't. I mean, when one says, by Jove, it doesn't mean you believe in Jupiter.
Yeah. In this month's Harper's, there's actually a really interesting review of this book by Marilyn Robinson. And she actually really takes you to task for claiming that this book is not scientific. I want to tell you specifically what she writes, and that is, his thinking is reminiscent of logical positivism. That school, however, which meant to carry out a purge of language it considered meaningless, specifically metaphysics and theology, by subjecting statement to the scientific test of verifiability, plunged into all sorts of interesting difficulty, as rigorous thoughts tend to do. Now, given that the argumentative style of this book is sort of very much about this logical positivism that she sort of actually pinpoints, is, are demolishing the arguments behind other people's statements really sort of the way to get your point across? Or is there, I noticed like the scientific aspect of this book sort of kicks in kind of midway, you know. What do you have any particular thoughts on what she's sort of saying here?
Logical positivism founded on the realization that there are plenty of statements that are not verifiable in the ordinary sense. I mean, any statement about right and wrong, for example, is not verifiable. I certainly wouldn't dispute that. However, existence claims or claims of miracles, claims that Jesus was born of a virgin, or Jesus rose from the dead, or healed lepers, or whatever it might be, those are straightforward scientific claims. If there was scientific evidence, if as I said in the book, if an unlikely set of circumstances forensic archaeologists discovered DNA evidence that Jesus never had a father, that would be used by theologians. They wouldn't say, "Oh, that's nothing to do with it, with us. That's a logical reasoning thing. That's theology doesn't work like that." Of course, they'd use it. It's a kind of one-way valve. You use scientific reasoning when it helps you, and you don't when it doesn't. So I've never claimed that science has anything to say about morality. I think the scientific way of thinking, skeptical way of thinking, has something to say about moral inconsistencies and consistencies in moral reasoning. But certainly science cannot verifiably show that something is right or something is wrong. But I believe the biggest existence claim of all, the existence or non-existence of a supernatural designer, I believe that is a scientific claim. It may not be scientifically verifiable, but it is a scientific claim in the sense that a universe with a God would be a very different kind of universe from one without a God.
Okay. Actually, I wanted to ask you, what of love? You kind of go into it a little bit into the book, but, you know, for example, speaking personally for myself, I'm madly in love with my girlfriend right now. But could I tell you, is there any sort of rational basis for this? No, not really. Would I do a lot for her? Well, absolutely. I would do inexplicable sorts of things that are just completely irrational for her.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that. I wouldn't call them completely irrational. If you're asking, how does either of you know that you love the other, then that is rational. I mean, that's based upon evidence. That's based upon little looks, smiles, catches in the voice, things you do for each other. That's all evidence. Just because it's subtle and complicated doesn't make it free from evidence. It is evidence-based. Of course, it could be wrong, but that's always true of evidence-based belief.
But I'm wondering if it's sort of a matter of perception, something that we sort of, you know, perceive in terms of the upturn of a sort of smile, or the, you know, this is something that is something that only one particular person is going to, you know, parse. It's not something that necessarily sort of spreads across a group.
No, it isn't. But that doesn't make it supernatural. I mean, it's a perfectly rational, logical statement to say, "I love my girlfriend and I think she loves me." Mm-hmm. There's nothing unscientific about that. It's just complicated.
It's more a matter of this sexual lust that you sort of described.
Oh well, and now you're asking a different question: where does it come from biologically? And sexual lust isn't all of it. It sexual lust manifests itself in very complicated ways in the highly sophisticated beings that humans are.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. I guess though, what I'm sort of wondering if there is sort of a compatibility between how one person loves another versus how one person, you know, might find some sort of, you know, things that they detect in religion that you or I may look at and say, well, this is absolutely nonsense, but for them, they'll sort of find clues that they can then possibly apply to their own life.
Suppose we make the comparison between love of one's girlfriend and love of God. Now, the girlfriend exists. You spend time together, you look at each other, you talk to each other, you smile at each other, listen to each other. The love of God is not, at least not obviously, of that category. There is no evidence that God exists at all. Now, it's perfectly possible for the human brain to conjure up an imaginary existence of something that isn't there. There are people, going back to sexual love, there are lunatics who believe that some famous film star loves them when they've never met this famous film star and never will, and the film star is totally unaware of their existence. That's a delusion. Mm-hmm. And so, but the feeling of love that they have for this film star and the deluded feeling that the film star loves them may seem exactly as real to the deluded brain of the fan.
So you would say that anyone who believes in a God would be suffering from a delusion, or is
well, I can't demonstrate that, but that's what I suspect. And all I'm doing at the moment is using that as an example to show that it doesn't follow that because the feeling that somebody has that they love God might feel rather similar to the feeling they have when they love their girlfriend. Mm-hmm. That doesn't prove that one is as real as the other.
Would you say that, you know, you often use the word fools in reference to people who do actually, in reference to deists, and I'm wondering if there are sort of shades of foolishness that people participate, or are people complete fools if they believe in God?
Do I use the word fool? I quote the word fool as coming from one of the Psalms. The fool has said in his heart, "There is no God." I can't remember any other place where I use the word fool in the book.
Okay, well, I'll have to double-check that. I actually wanted to ask you, too, to sort of draw another comparison, and then we'll wrap this up. You sort of, you know, a major concern for you in this book, particularly near the end, is the susceptibility of children
Very
to religion.
Very much so, yes.
And I wanted to ask, though, whether it's religion or a sort of general incorrigible impulse. For example, here in the States, we have an advertising industry that spends $12 billion a year trying to create commercials designed to get small children who are 4 years old to recognize brand names. And that particular sort of really, in my view anyway, despicable sort of impulse is very similar, I suppose, to the despicable impulse that people, that religious fundamentalists
yes,
use.
Yes, I hadn't thought of that before, but it does seem to me to be despicable in very much the same kind of way, mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm just wondering, though, does it come necessarily from the actual source, like religion or advertising, or does it come from like some sort of independent free will? I mean, you know, it seems to me that these people deliberately want to prey upon this, in no pun intended, you know?
Yeah. Not quite sure what you're asking there. I think, in a way, what I find even more objectionable than the indoctrination of children, whether it's with brand recognition or religion, is the labeling of children. Because children are, from the earliest babyhood, labeled with the religion of their parents. This is a Catholic baby. Mm-hmm. It's been baptized. And I don't think anyone would say, even of a child who's been brainwashed into recognizing a particular brand of soft drink or something, I must avoid using a particular name, I guess. But you would not say, that is a Coca-Cola child.
Yeah.
You might say that child has been brainwashed to recognize a particular brand, but you wouldn't actually tie a label around the child's neck. So the religious one is even worse, because it actually takes children and classifies them as members of a religion, which for no better reason than that their parents belong to it.
But perhaps it's even worse with advertising, because these kids are now sort of shouting Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola at the television set, as opposed to like if they go see a nativity scene or something, a nativity play, they're not necessarily going to chant, you know, Christ, Christ, Christ.
Have you seen the film Jesus Camp?
No, I haven't.
Well, I haven't either, but I've seen a trailer for it. I recommend that have a look at it. It's absolutely horrifying.
Wow.
And they precisely would chant that kind of thing.
I have
and
heard of these things.
Exactly like Hitler Youth. It's maybe even worse than Hitler Youth.
But we're talking on a sort of, I guess, less sort of extreme kind of level where, you know, something like advertising comes through our televisions, comes through our magazines, and it's something that is essentially a very populist kind of approach of, you know, brainwashing people. Whereas, I mean, one can probably maybe make a slight case for the Sunday morning sort of televangelists like Oral Roberts and Jerry Falwell and the like. But simultaneously, though, it's you don't have kids shouting sort of God or Christ or whatever at the screen. They're just sort of actually, but they are doing this with sort
of. Okay, I mean, you're probably right, but I mean, do have a look at Jesus Camp, because you'll be confounded there.
Okay.
They are exactly shouting God and Jesus, and when we're Jesus children, and marching for Jesus, and they do military drill for Jesus, and they're explicitly being drilled for a warlike crusade for Jesus.
But are you saying that this sort of really hardcore fundamentalist approach is just like one step removed from totally being pervasive or virulent in the culture?
I must be careful not to suggest that all religion is like that. Of course it isn't. This is the ugly face of Christianity. But I think the less ugly face, it could be said to pave the way, to make the world safe mm-hmm. for the ugly face. One of the great pernicious things that children are taught is the virtue of faith. Mm-hmm. They're taught that faith is a virtue, that to believe something because you have faith is somehow even better than to believe it because you have evidence for it. That really is pernicious. Mm-hmm. That is the start of the road to extremism, where people of extremist tendencies can say, I don't have to justify my belief that it's my duty to go on a suicide mission, to murder people. God wants me to do it. I don't have to defend that. That's my faith. You're not allowed to question my faith. It's impolite. It's bad manners to question my faith. It's not like things that you believe by virtue of evidence. Now, that belief that faith trumps everything is taught to children, not by extremists. That's taught to children by nice, decent, pleasant, the sort of people you'd like to know, Sunday school teachers. And so they are preparing the child mind, preparing the mind for the later pernicious extremism that will follow.
But that's just one case. There's a fundamental difference between someone who decides to become a suicide bomber and someone who basically lives a fairly normal, inoffensive life to both, you know, hardcore extremists or atheists, you know?
I follow Sam Harris in this, his two excellent books, The End of Faith and Letter to a Christian Nation, where he does suggest that these nice, moderate religious people are paving the way, are making the world safe for the extremists, which they would be horrified at. I mean, of course they don't support the extremists. Nevertheless, by making faith into a virtue, by teaching that it's a virtue to believe things for which there's no evidence, talking snakes and all that sort of stuff, that softens the mind up for the extremists when they come and say, you don't have to justify it, there's no evidence. We have faith that we're going to go to paradise if we go on a suicide mission.
So it's really about a matter of basically being more susceptible to rationalism being dismantled. That's basically...
I suppose that's one way to put it, yes.
Okay. Professor Dawkins, thank you very much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Love you, but long as there are stars above you, you never need to doubt it. I'll make you so sure about it. God only knows what I'd be without.